the 19th of August 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Does Carol Vorderman's report on maths education add up, or does it have a really high APR in the small print? Why has an American school board banned Slaughterhouse-5? Why is the House of Commons no laughing matter? Is the arms trade no better than slavery? Does India qualify as a geek nation, or has it yet to reach level 70 in World of Warcraft? Can you identify as both a Christian and a skeptic, or do you have to be in the trinity of a Christian, a skeptic, and the Holy Ghost? And why is pregnancy a minefield of nonsense? But first, next time you go to A&E, should you ask for a VAT receipt? Plans have been unveiled recently to give NHS patients a receipt showing how much money their care has cost. I guess the idea is that patients will moan less about taxes and stuff like that if they can see how expensive it all actually is. What surprises me, though, is that I thought of this idea years ago, but I thought it should apply to all of government. So at the end of the tax year, you should get an itemised receipt telling you what your taxes have bought. Think of the smiles of satisfaction and joy on people's faces as they find out how many cluster bombs and speed cameras their hard-earned money has bought. But back to the NHS proposals, though, and Dr. Simon Howard doesn't think this is such a good idea. You could say he's got a bit of a bee in his bonnet. Maybe you should go and see a doctor about that. Here's Simon with more.
Last Friday, Mike Farrer, the new chief executive of the NHS Confederation, told The Times that he thought people should be told the cost of their NHS treatment in an effort to reduce wasteful use of the NHS. Well, that's not actually quite what he said. He created this new, really irritating term, care footprint, but the idea was there. He also said that these charges should be broken down into discretionary and non-discretionary use of the NHS. The distinction between the two, in his mind, is that discretionary use of the NHS is related to lifestyle choices, and non-discretionary use is related to accidents and inherited diseases. Now, quite how accidents aren't related to lifestyle choices is actually beyond me. And how do you separate out the inherited and lifestyle components of most diseases? Take diabetes, for example. Is osteoarthritis in an athlete a lifestyle disease? Oh, the whole thing's actually crazy. Nothing in the real world is that straightforward and has an etiology that's that simple to explain. The suggestion seems so ludicrous to me that I'm actually finding it difficult to talk about without getting angry. Yet a few years ago, I would probably have agreed with him. So what's happened? Why have I gone from thinking this was a fairly good idea, and why do I now think it's totally balmy? Well, I used to think it was a good idea because I thought there was a lot of willful misuse of the NHS by people who saw it as a free entitlement. That's a view that quite a lot of doctors hold. I thought that people needed to be sensible and think about their use of the NHS. Anyone watching 24 Hours in A&E a couple of weeks ago would have tutted along with the A&E staff on the programme when the bloke who'd had a splinter in his finger for a month walked in. That's the kind of guy Farrer wants to target with his cost information. He wants to let the bloke know how much his visit to A&E cost after the fact. That used to seem a sensible argument to me, but what good is it actually likely to do? That bloke turned up to A&E, presumably because either he didn't know that wasn't the right place to go, or the alternative services weren't available to him. Both of those are the fault of the NHS, not the fault of the bloke with the splinter. If he's properly pointed in the right direction at that attendance at A&E, then he won't come back unnecessarily, regardless of whether he receives information on about the cost of his attendance. If he's not told where he should have gone in the first place, then he'll likely be back, regardless of whether he receives information on the cost of his attendance or not, because he won't know where else to go. We all complain, and I include myself in this, about folk taking up GP appointments with colds asking for unnecessary antibiotics. That's likely either because some doctors give them antibiotics or because they have something that they think is more than a cold. If doctors are giving them antibiotics, then those doctors are wrong and the patients turning up asking for them are their fault, the NHS's fault, not the patient's. If the patient thinks they genuinely have more than a cold, that is, they're genuinely worried about their symptoms, then their attendance is entirely justified. We as doctors are constantly banging on about getting patients in if they're worried about symptoms. We have far too many patients still who leave conditions too late before coming in. the more we encourage people to come in early, the more we will also, by definition, encourage attendances that we see as wasteful. What's needed is the right action and the right advice. Information on the cost of appointments isn't really going to alter things one way or the other. Personally, I'd happily see 10 patients with colds if it had stopped one really advanced cancer presenting late. But providing people with the cost of their appointments will put people off attending. That's the point. The patients who present late do so often because they're stoical and don't want to bother the doctor. Telling them that seeing the doctor costs some extortionate amount of money isn't going to chivvy them into the consulting room. It's going to put them off and make things worse. On top of all of that, how does Mr. Farah propose that we work out the cost of an appointment? What proportion of a receptionist's salary is dedicated to an individual patient? How much of the surgery's heating bill? How much of the cost of the time of the folk who maintain the electronic note-keeping software? How much of the cost of the thermometer that takes the patient's temperature? There's no way that that data can be accurately and logically calculated. Now, I know many people will point out that businesses come up with that level of data all the time. I don't dispute that. But businesses operate in the commercial sector. They've done it since they started. They know how to do it. The NHS hasn't, and the NHS doesn't. To go through and make cost calculations for all the tiny little steps that make up our lifetime's interaction with the NHS is a massive undertaking, and I don't think it has much actual reward. Imagine, though, in an ideal world, that the NHS did have that data. Who is then going to coordinate the letter going out to the patient with a breakdown of costs? The bureaucracy involved in that system would be massive. The printing and postage costs alone would be huge. The cost of such a system would be much better ploughed into any number of things in the NHS. Perhaps a slice of it could be used to educate people about which services they should actually use and when they should access them. In the end, I think we have to accept that people aren't health experts. That's why the NHS is needed. Not everybody's a doctor. That means that people will occasionally misjudge the severity of their condition one way or the other. People will access inappropriate services. And if you raise the threshold at which people feel able to access services, then you raise the number of people who attend late. What's more, the small number of people who do maliciously attend inappropriately are not going to be affected by information that says that a consultation costs X amount of money. They're attending maliciously, they know they're in the wrong, and they don't care. For all of those reasons, I'm really disappointed to see the new chief executive of the NHS Confederation suggesting this flawed idea that's been round the houses tens of times. I really hope he has a fairly rapid rethink. This has been Simon Howard reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Carol Vorderman hit the headlines a couple of weeks ago. It turns out that she's been writing a report for the Tories on maths education. I know what you're thinking. She's been working for the Tories? Well, she can consonant, vowel, consonant, consonant off. But did the report actually have any merit? Surprisingly, it didn't propose consolidating all of the maths down into one easy, manageable monthly maths lesson, but instead suggests making kids do even more maths. To find out more, here's our mathematics correspondent. That's right. We have a mathematics correspondent, Peter Rowlett, with more.
An item you may have missed last week, just before the rioting really spread nationwide on Monday, though I don't think it was a root cause, was the publication by the Conservative Party of the report on the Task Force on Mathematics Education in England, chaired by Carol Vorderman. As someone with a professional interest in mathematics education, albeit at a higher education level, this is a big deal, and I was interested in the report and in views on it. The headline recommendations, widely reported, are compulsory study of maths to 18 and a splitting of maths into two GCSEs. Reaction I've seen from individuals on Twitter and on newspaper website comment sections has been largely negative. If kids don't like maths, just let them study other subjects. Math is useless anyway, right? Much comment I've seen is also negative about Carol Vorderman. A comment posted this week on the BBC News website by user Sag45 seems typical. Since Miss Vorderman is not a teacher, and indeed has a rather poor degree, I find it amazing that she feels qualified to express these views. She is a television presenter and not a teacher. Is this view correct? Really, I don't care about Carol Vorderman. I'm not impressed by celebrity. I don't like her. And I don't dislike her. I don't know her. But in any case, the question of who should lead the task force was one for 2.5 years ago when it was launched. The report was written by a group who consulted widely. Let's look at what the report actually says before jumping to conclusions about it. Actually, there is one thing said in relation to Ms. Vorderman that annoys me. I should be careful to say she doesn't claim this herself, but people say she's a mathematician. Unless there's some aspect to her work that I don't know about, then she isn't a mathematician. She's very quick at mental arithmetic, and that's impressive, but it isn't the work of a mathematician. If you think it is, then you don't understand what mathematics is. Hint, try this exercise. Think about the spelling, handwriting and grammar that you did in school. Now think about great works of literature, your favourite book, a beautiful poem, that play you saw the other year. Right, now think about the arithmetic, geometry and algebra you did in school. Are you with me? Anyway, I got snagged on a pet peeve. Back to the report. This is titled A World-Class Mathematics Education for All Our Young People. Michael Gove, in the preface, argues that mathematical knowledge is vital to personal and societal economic success. More than ever, society becomes more complex, but that England is failing to live up to the challenge of mathematics education. If I could summarise the report's key argument, with apologies for inaccuracy, it's a 108-page report, and I'm fast running out of my allotted time. The report proposes a cycle of activity. So, while some young people in England receive an excellent mathematics education from excellent teachers, many do not. Many primary school teachers lack confidence in teaching mathematics, so many children arrive at secondary school with a low standard of and confidence in mathematics. Many children underperform in secondary school, where there is a shortage of specialist maths teachers. GCSEs cater for the around a half of students who will pass at grade A star to C, and don't serve very well those who won't. Few students do any maths post 16. At university, many courses are unable to fill their places with students with sufficient knowledge of appropriate mathematics. Many leave school or university to companies who complain they are unable to recruit people with the mathematical skills they need. Some leave university and, though lacking a sufficient knowledge of and confidence in mathematics, become teachers and proceed to educate the next generation of children. And this is all made worse by a misguided central management that forces an emphasis on testing. The report makes recommendations around changed policy and relaxed regulation, increasing the maths entry requirement for training of primary school teachers, and improving teacher continuing professional development. Two GCSEs, compulsory maths in some form to the age of 18, something done in most developed countries, and that doesn't mean A-level maths for all, and much more. Taught by more confident teachers early and able to take a different academic route post-14, the report expects students will leave better prepared with the maths they need for life. I have a fuller list and a link to the report in a blog post, a link to which will appear on the Pod Delusion website. So, are the problems highlighted by the report real? Well, a large number of experts and organisations, as well as students and parents, contributed data to the task force, and the findings are certainly in line with a number of other government and non-government reports of recent years. Are the recommendations to tackle those problems the right one? This is, of course, hard to say. Education is a difficult area for policy because everyone's experienced education, so a lot of people think they have an expert opinion. But they've all experienced education at different times in different schools. Plus, it is difficult to do properly controlled trials to determine clear evidence. The members of the task force are a well-respected bunch, and there's some logic to the recommendations they make, as well as positive reaction from every major organisation I can find, including the relevant professional bodies, the Institute of Mathematics and its applications, and the Royal Statistical Society, the CBI, the Royal Society, and many others. Some newspaper comment articles and several blog posts I've seen were positive about rising to the challenge. I went to the internet seeking dissenting views about the report and not about Carol. Kevin Hisson blogs worrying where the extra teachers are coming from to teach two separate GCSEs and a lot of extra students from 16 to 18. A blog post at fullfact.org questions the report's use of the data on international comparisons of mathematics education, a comparison that is used in the report to highlight the status of English maths education compared with other developed countries. The blog Political Scrapbook points out the report praises private tuition and is concerned about the conflict of interest because Carol runs an online private tuition company. Some dissent then, but really not much. I've hardly found anyone who seems to have actually read the report publicly saying anything negative about its recommendations, although I have heard a few private grumbles with some of the detail. So what will happen next? This is also very difficult to say. This is an independent report commissioned by the Conservative Party, so it isn't a government document. Michael Gove is on record saying the report will be a great help to government, but what does that mean? Being left on the shelf, or having wholesale recommendations cherry-picked, or being abandoned with a change of minister or government, these are all challenges facing a newly published report. It remains to be seen how this one will fare. This is Peter Rowlett, searching through the haystack of opinion about Carol for the Pod Delusion.
Now, over in America, a school board has gone and banned Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, presumably mistaking the world-renowned work of literature for a violent video game. As you might expect, I'm opposed to all book banning in general. I'm a vociferous reader myself. At the moment, I'm working my way through the latest work by Argos. It's a bit of a long read, but it is extensively well-referenced and very detailed. I'm not done quite yet, but I reckon it's going to turn out it was the butler in the kitchen with the pro power bench with 40kg weight set. But why is banning Slaughterhouse-Five a bad idea? Here's Salim Fadley with more.
Wesley Scroggins, a Missouri State University professor of management, has fought and won a one-man battle to have certain books banned from the public schools in the city of Republic, Missouri. It's not uncommon for American school boards to ban books for ideological reasons. Many of the greatest American novels, such as Twain's Huckleberry Finn, have been banned by school boards, ironically also in Missouri, the state where Twain was himself born. Actually, I could go on for the whole show, listing the numerous great American books which are banned by small-minded public servants. However, today I'd rather talk with Mark Leeds, who was himself a personal friend of the satirist Kurt Vonnegut, and the author of the Kurt Vonnegut Encyclopedia. Last month, the Republic School Board voted 4-0 in favour of banning a small selection of books, including Kurt Vonnegut's most famous novel, Slaughterhouse-Five. 42 years after its original publication, why does this book remain so controversial?
I think that there is a portion of society who blush every time they read a four-letter word, regardless of its context. When Saving Private Ryan came out, American television made a very big deal to show it uncut, with all the cursing, with all of the gore and everything else. And for some reason, Spielberg was never defamed in the same manner that Vonnegut was for basically presenting the same characters, people who were stuck in a war, not of their own choosing, but going off to war, and every once in a while saying motherfucker, every once in a while seeing absolutely horrendous things happen to human beings. And for some reason, Vonnegut is this lightning rod in America.
The subtitle of the book is The Children's Crusade. It's partly a war story told from the perspective of Vonnegut himself as a young man who was a prisoner of war during the Dresden bombings. So along with Catch-22, this is one of the most compelling depictions of the horrors of war in American satire. Do you think this makes some people all the more eager to ban this particular book?
I think Americans don't like to think of anything but clean victory. And anything that shows the ugliness of having to achieve victory, nobody ever got on Joseph Heller's ass for his viewpoints when it came to the Catch-22. So, again, there is something about Vonnegut, and I think it might be because he's a German-American. I think that because he was partly from that caste known as German-Americans, he has been reviled in some corners.
Slaughterhouse-Five is not just a war memoir. The plot is quite unusual in that it jumps forwards and backwards through time, juxtaposing seemingly random moments from the protagonist's life. It's a complex structure, and yet it's very simple to read.
You know, that's one of the real beautiful things about it. It is unmistakable on every page. Kurt works out each page, each set of paragraphs that go together, each vignette, or when I hear my students respond to it, they just shake their head in agreement and say, yeah, but why is it like that? I can't explain to them why it is like that. It just simply is. I mean, there's a very honest reflection in everything he's written in that book, and yet it comes off so easily.
And yet it almost shouldn't go so easily, because he's tackled the hardest issues, like how we understand war, how we treat our veterans. But he's told this story disarmingly through a really twisted science fiction story.
It should be the worst of all stories to try to explain. You know, the American columnist George Will loves to remind people that, oh yes, Kurt Vonnegut is very upset about those Germans who died that night, but he says nothing about all of those people in the concentration camps. That's not really true. The story was about Dresden. It wasn't about Auschwitz. And since when should a writer not be allowed to write about what they witness?
This is not the first time that Vonnegut's books have been banned from a public school system.
The very idea of banning books in America seems to me to be the most un-American thing to do. Because if free speech is supposed to be a hallmark of American society, you just simply have to let things be out there. Hopefully you will educate people so they can understand what it is they are reading, and they can bring some, which I go back to Scroggins, and he's just proof that you can get a degree and be stupid.
In the UK, we know Kurt as an author. However, he was also the honorary president of the American Humanist Association. Can you talk about Kurt's humanism?
I view his humanism as the only sane response to the shit that we keep putting ourselves through. Just yesterday in Iowa, Michelle Bachmann won the straw poll in Ames, Iowa. That blows my mind. I think that Bachmann, Palin, and even Perry, now that he's in the race, they represent a confidence in their Christian ideology, which I think Vonnegut looks at over the course of history and saying, if you take a look at the numbers of wars that the world has endured, how many of them sprang from religious intolerance of one sort or another? I think one of the most important books that Vonnegut ever wrote was Cat's Cradle. That whole book is set up to show you how artificial are some of our beliefs, including, I think, some of our democratic principles. Vonnegut takes it and strips it bare and say, as he did with Slaughterhouse-Five, if you take a look at the reading level of that text, you know, a fourth grader could read it and understand it at a certain level.
Finally, the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library has announced an offer for the students of Republic, Missouri. The library is offering a free copy of the banned book Slaughterhouse-Five for any student who wishes to find out more about this novel.
My first response when I heard about the book banning was I wrote to Julia Whitehead and I said, what we should do is get 50 copies and tell the students in Republic that the first 50 who ask for it will receive a free copy of the book. At the same time that I was writing this, Kurt's artistic collaborator, Joe Petro III, he was so pissed off that he told Julia, if you can get Random House to supply the books, I will hand calligraphy the mailing labels and they can pay for the postage to all of the students in Republic. So everybody had the same idea at once. They're going to ban the book. Let's throw the books right at them. This was a shameful act to take books away from children. That's insane. And they'll be able to look back and say, we were part of that. And they're going to look at the book and say, over this? This is what they didn't want us to see? Are you kidding me?
I'll give the final words to Julia Whitehead. She's the executive director of the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library. She said, it's not clear to me whether any of the adults making these important decisions in our public schools have actually read these books. All of these students will be eligible to vote, and some may be protecting our country through military service in the next year or two. It's shocking and unfortunate that these young adults and citizens would not be considered mature enough to handle the important topics raised by Kurt Vonnegut, a decorated war veteran. Everyone can learn something from his book. This is Salim Fadli for The Pod Delusion.
Now, is there a conspiracy between the government, the royal family, and the BBC to censor freedom of expression? Probably not. But even so, it's a bit dodgy that these institutions have been involved in trying to censor satirists by not allowing them to use footage of Parliament and the royal wedding for satirical purposes. Intrigued? It's certainly not a laughing matter. So here's Blakely Nixon with more.
Political satire has been a staple of British culture for centuries. Many Brits consider this country to be a bastion of satirical comedy. From crude punch cartoons to publications like Private Eye and sitcoms like Blackadder, Yes Minister and The Thick of It, satirical comedy has been essential not only in making us laugh, but in speaking truth to power and exposing incompetence, hypocrisy and corruption at every level of our political institutions. So many of us were surprised to hear that in recent months our institutions and broadcasters have worked actively to undermine and perhaps even censor satirical comedy. What follows are two examples of how three highly respected British institutions, and Channel 4, worked to set the limits of what can be satirised. And this was not just in the UK, but in two foreign countries. Remember April this year? The world was going mad with what the media dubbed royal wedding fever. This was the same media, by the way, that managed to convince us that the daughter of a millionaire was a commoner, and that her choice of wedding dress was somehow important and newsworthy. The Chaser, a satirical comedy group in Australia, have planned to provide an alternative take on the wedding of Mr. Windsor and Miss Middleton. I interview Craig Rucastle, one of the Chasers, about their plans.
For those in Britain who don't know about the Chaser, can you explain what it is you guys do?
Over the years, kind of political and media satire, but we've also done kind of stunts in the street and that kind of thing. But what we've done a lot of the time is we've actually done stunts and interacted with the politicians, but not in a normal kind of face-to-face press conference style. We kind of choose when we want to talk to the politician and chase them down. The only thing that might have got as far as the UK that we've ever done is during APEC when George Bush was here, we managed to get a fake motorcade through all the security and right next to George Bush's hotel with one of our team members dressed as Osama bin Laden. So that was an interesting day at the office. But, yeah, we've done quite a mix of stuff over the years.
Right. And what were your plans for the royal wedding?
It was a new show again. We were planning to do a 3 or 4 hour live commentary of the royal wedding. And we kind of prepared a bit of stuff, some sketches and done a lot of research. And we were basically going to be calling it and placing a lot of graphics over the top of it and, you know, commentating the wedding in a probably, you know, not maybe quite as respectful as the BBC would have been doing, but still, you know, great deal of deference for the royals, naturally. Part of the problem with that question is that we don't exactly know what would have come out because it wasn't going to be a scripted show. So who knows? But we had a lot of stuff prepared and who knows where it would have gone.
So what happened then exactly? What were the series of events that led up to you being, well, what you, I guess you would say effectively censored?
What happened was that we were going to be getting a stream of the royal wedding. I mean, ABC had a couple of channels and on ABC One was going to be playing the actual BBC One. And we were going to initially take the BBC feed and then just take a clean feed and kind of do our own commentary and add our own stuff over the top. After a little while, we decided that the BBC wouldn't necessarily be the best one to look for. And we found other, I think at some point during that, there might have been some concern that the BBC might restrict on the basis of satire. And we actually ended up finding other providers who had no requirements, you know, nothing that actually said you couldn't use the footage for satire or parody. And unfortunately what happened is that the BBC, in consultation with Clarence House, basically tracked down all the other providers and told them that they had to ensure that there was a restriction on satire in the broadcast, and specifically also went to the ABC and told them that they would not be getting the feed if the Chaser was getting to use it in any way.
So you've run into trouble before, and it looks like you didn't anticipate any controversy with this commentary. But do you ever intentionally cross the line or push the boundaries of what's sort of acceptable with satire?
You don't necessarily go there to, you know, create controversy. Although that said, if it occurs, we don't exactly run from it. We enjoy it while it's happening. But what's strange over the many years of doing this is that how often we've predicted it wrong. So recently we had one episode where we got in quite a lot of trouble and got pulled off air for a couple of weeks by the ABC. And the sketch that we did that led to that was in an episode where one of the other items we thought might be controversial and, you know, we were worried about, but we weren't necessarily worried about the one that got us in trouble. So you can never really tell what's going to get you in trouble.
Do you believe that there should be no limits to satire, and do you put limits on your own work?
theoretically, I don't think there should really be any limits, but there are. I mean, there are times, there are certainly times that in our writers' meeting, you know, we will maybe rule out something on the basis that the message will be lost. And I think many years ago, the Bali bombing, which I guess was, you know, like the attacks in London that you had, the Bali bombing killed a lot of Australians. And we wanted to do a piece that was very much fairly and squarely aimed at the media coverage of it. But in the end, we couldn't find a way to do it in a way that people would actually understand it was about the media, that they wouldn't get caught up and think we were just basically making jokes about the dead. So we didn't do that in that case. But having said that, we've done songs about, you know, we've done the eulogy song in the past, which got us in quite a lot of trouble, which was about various people who died in Australia. And that, you know, that certainly put some people offside. But, yeah, it's always hard to tell.
Okay, something that has made the news, although not big news over here, is the fact that the Daily Show episode was prevented from broadcasting here because it showed footage from within the House of Commons.
Mm.
This is down to parliamentary regulations that says that nothing can be broadcast that undermines the dignity of the House. Have you come across similar restrictions in Australia and with the Chaser?
We have the same restrictions here, and it's interesting because I've just put in a submission on behalf of the Chaser to the parliamentary inquiry into our media laws here at the moment. I'm very keen to test them because we have laws that the footage of Parliament cannot be broadcast in for satire or ridicule, which is similar to the UK laws. And what's fascinating about that is that I don't know what its purpose really is. All of the kind of embarrassing clips of parliamentarians get played on the news and all the kind of parliamentary shows. But what it prevents is what you occasionally do see on shows like Jon Stewart's show, which is that it prevents a kind of satirical analysis of what's actually been said in the House, which is a great shame, I think. And we're very keen to get those laws changed. And if you can push to change them over there as well, it'll help, hopefully.
As if the BBC and Clarence House working to undermine the free speech rights of a group of Australian comedians wasn't enough. Much like The Chaser, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart was also prevented from satirising the royal wedding. But a few weeks ago, The Daily Show was censored by another British institution. Helen Lewis-Hasterly is a deputy editor of The New Statesman and has written extensively on the subject of satire.
How did this situation emerge with the pulling of The Daily Show episode from More 4?
Well, what was interesting about it was the fact that this satire ban has been in force for years, decades, as far as we can see. People obviously realising that Spitting Image never used any footage from the House of Commons or, you know, things like that. But I wasn't aware of it until a blogger on Twitter actually spoke to Graham Linehan, the comedy writer, about it, saying that the latest global edition of The Daily Show hadn't been aired and they wanted to know why on earth that would be. And then Channel 4, who are also on Twitter, mad new media story that this is, then said, well, actually, it's because we can't show parliamentary footage. And what was amazing about it was actually Jon Stewart, the Daily Show's host, really praising David Cameron for the Commons debate, if you remember, after the phone hacking, where he stood up for about, I don't know, something like 2.5 hours taking on questions. And Jon Stewart, you know, praised him. He said, you know, Obama gives a sort of kind of 10-minute press conference from Mexico, whereas, you know, this is the Prime Minister of Great Britain, you know, down in the ring taking on all comers.
Okay, but I mean, what are the guidelines surrounding using parliamentary images or images from within the House?
So you can use them, you can't use them in a show which is branded as a comedy show. You can use it in a variety show which has comedic elements in it. But, for example, Charlie Brooker said that the same thing had applied to his Newswipe show, because that, again, is a comedy show. Whereas we had a long discussion about whether or not, something like the Daily Politics, obviously, uses humour quite a lot. And at what point does that cross from being a news show that has a bit of humour into it into being a humour show, at which point they wouldn't be allowed to use any parliamentary footage?
OK, and has this ever been challenged? I mean, to your knowledge, has anybody ever been taken to court, or has a broadcaster ever tried to satirise footage from Parliament?
Not to my knowledge. The one thing that I do know that might happen is that the MP, the Tory MP, Louise Mensch, who is on the Department of Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, did hear about all this and said that she would introduce an early day motion. Now, that's, you know, I think that's probably more likely to be a gesture, because things like this, you know, we had an argument about the alternative vote not so long ago, where the argument was made that, you know, with the economy down the toilet and all this sort of stuff, we haven't got time to talk about voting. So I imagine that we have got even less time to talk about political satire.
Right. I mean, and I guess that sort of ties in with my next question is, what do you think we can do about it?
Well, I mean, there's several ways we could go about it. We could do a kind of I Am Spartacus thing where everybody does lots of YouTube mashups of parliamentary footage. Again, you can write to your MP and say, please support this early day motion if it does actually make the parliamentary timetable. I mean, certainly things blogging about it and writing about it and making other people aware of it. There is also on the Downing Street e-petition site, an e-petition. But I have to say, I'm afraid I'm sort of slightly principally opposed to the Downing e-petition site. So that's not necessarily a route that I'd advocate going down.
With the sort of ban on the royal wedding satire and this current situation in Parliament, and this is, you're perhaps one of the best people to ask this, is this an example of the slow death of British satire?
Well, funnily enough, I'm just currently in the middle of writing an article on that, and I've been talking to quite a lot of comic writers about it. So there's the perspective of somebody like Steve Punt, who writes for The Now Show on Radio 4. And his point that he makes, which he makes very compellingly, is that, well, two things. One, that there was never really a golden age of British satire. We look back to things like Beyond the Fringe or That Was the Week That Was or Spitting Image. And actually, with the benefit of hindsight, we imbue them with more satire than they contained. His point is that Spitting Image, for example, did a lot better in the ratings when it was doing stuff about Madonna than when it was doing stuff about, you know, Margaret Thatcher. So actually there's that idea, is the idea that there was a golden age of satire is slightly false, particularly in TV terms. The second part of it is, actually, I think that there's a lot of incredibly good satire recently. I mean, I would point to, so slightly further back, things like Brass Eye, for example, and several of the writers who were involved in that have gone on to other things. The thick of it, obviously, very successful British satire. I mean, 10 O'Clock Live, which I've written about before, I didn't think worked as it was, but definitely had the gems of, you know, there are definitely writers out there who can do this kind of thing. And actually, one of the things that I would point to as being incredibly successful is the Daily Mash, the website, which operates, you know, it is a business. Its two founders take a salary from it. And employs comedy writers, and it gets a million, you know, in the millions of page impressions a month. The point about it is, and this is something that Ian Martin, who's one of the writers in the thick of it, said, is that the only prerequisite for satire is anger. And actually, I think that this is quite an angry time, because people are struggling, because the economy is poor, because there's a perception that politicians don't have the same problems that we do. And I think that the current political climate is one that will produce some incredible satire.
So there you have it. The BBC, the monarchy, and our democratically elected parliament, all working actively to undermine a basic human right. The right to use humour as a way of questioning authority and examining our key institutions. This is Blakely Nixon for The Pod Delusion.
You can find links to find out more about the Chasers and Helen Lewis on the Pod Delusion website at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, what's the difference between the arms trade and the slave trade? Not that much by the sound of it, if Henry Boddington's report next is anything to go by. So here he is, depressing us with why.
On the 13th to the 16th of September, London is to host one of the best and biggest events of the year. It was last held in our capital in 2009, with just under 100 countries participating, over 1,200 exhibitors and over 25,000 attendees. And this year, it's going to be even bigger. If you haven't guessed it yet, I am, of course, talking about the DSEI, or the Defence and Security Equipment International Arms Fair, which you, the taxpayer, are helping to host. Considering the events of this year, and with all the rhetoric from our politicians deploring the use of state force against their own citizens, it seems a touch duplicitous to host an event where countries from around the world with questionable human rights are invited to gorge themselves on the latest British-made instruments of doom. A couple of centuries ago, Britain was equally blighted with an industry that exported misery and death on an epic scale. Today, we are posed with a similar economic, political and moral conundrum to that of the export of slaves. In 1769, the slave James Somerset was brought to England. He was the property of Charles Stuart, a customs officer from Boston, Massachusetts, then a British colony in North America. Somerset ran away in 1771, but was recaptured and imprisoned upon a ship bound for the British colony of Jamaica. People claiming to be Somerset's godparents made an application before the court of the King's Bench for a writ of habeas corpus, and the captain of the ship was ordered to produce Somerset before the court of King's Bench, which would determine whether his imprisonment was legal.
the Chief Justice of the King's Bench, Lord Mansfield, presided over the case that began in February 1772. The case attracted much attention from the press, with activists and industrialists making donations to fund lawyers for both sides of the argument. On behalf of Somerset, it was argued that while colonial laws might permit slavery, neither the common law of England nor any law made by Parliament recognised the existence of slavery, and slavery was therefore illegal. Moreover, English contract law did not allow for any person to enslave himself, nor could any contract be binding without the person's consent. The lawyers for Charles Stuart argued that property was paramount, and it would be very dangerous to free all black people in England. It took Lord Mansfield over a month to reach the judgment that Somerset be set free, as there was no common law that could permit the forcible removal of slaves from England against their own will. While the slave trade continued throughout the British Empire until the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833, some 60 years later, the Somerset case was the launchpad for the emancipation of slaves throughout the British Empire, and subsequently, the rest of the world. The slave merchants who funded Stuart's defence were not at all anxious about the fate of James Somerset, but were concerned about how abolition might affect their overseas interests. A substantial proportion of the British Empire's economy was bound up in the slave trade. Slaves were captured and traded in West Africa for gold and goods, and then shipped off to the colonies to work on plantations. The harvest was sent back to England, where there was a great demand, giving rise to a roaring trade that called for more ships, whips and leg irons to be built to transport more slaves to the colonies. Moving forward to today, and for decades, we have manufactured and sold weapons to odious regimes and dictators around the world. We have watched our leaders cozy up to criminals and murderers to sell them the tools of oppression, and then later, well, sometimes, condemn them for their transgressions. There is apparently a multitude of safeguards and laws ensuring that the weapon sold will not be used for oppression. Yet, as we are seeing today with Libya and other countries in North Africa and the Middle East, we have no control over how the weapons are used once in the regime's possession. The arguments for continuing to manufacture weapons for export are bound like those of perpetuating the slave trade. It is often stated that our economic future depends on the continuing trade, providing vital employment while we receive concessions on essential imports, like oil. Thus, our dependence on this trade merry-go-round is too entrenched to simply stop altogether. According to Global Security, in 2010, the UK defence industry represented 10% of UK manufacturing, was number one in Europe, and second only to the US globally, employing over 300,000 people and generating over £35 billion per year to the UK economy, with exports totalling £5 billion. These figures are debated by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, or CAT, who assert that the true figure of employment is closer to 210,000 people, with 55,000 of those involved in arms exports. Today we look back on the slave trade as a shameful and indefensible stain on our past. However, to capture human beings, imprison them and ship them off to some recess in the far corner of the world to be worked to death was not only common practice, but commonly accepted as well. Today we seem to have made peace with the fact that death and oppression is an unfortunate byproduct of the weapons export business. And why? Because we have fed the lie that export of British-made weapons are good for our economy, UK-based employment and trade. Dean Baker, the co-director of the Centre for Economic Policy Research, in his article, The Economic Impact of the Iraq War and Higher Military Spending, states, "Military spending drains resources from the productive economy. It will typically lead to slower economic growth, less investment, higher trade deficits and fewer jobs," end quote. According to figures from CAT, subsidising the arms manufacturers in the UK cost the taxpayers approximately £700 million a year through helping with marketing, financing, research and development. Money spent in armaments is a dead-end street. There is a very limited rationale behind stating that it is good for our economy to spend so much money on a product that is absolutely useless. Just think of the very positive benefits that annually could be done with £700 million, say it were being spent on education, health or the environment. The world is thought to have spent on average some $1 trillion per annum on armaments over the last 50 years. A bit of it has gone bang, and when it has done so, it has destroyed itself, and it has also destroyed something that somebody else has spent time creating. Weapons have a very specific function. They don't create, they are not benevolent or altruistic tools, and more often, they end up oppressing rather than liberating. And what are the people employed in the manufacture of armaments? What would they be doing if they weren't creating destructive equipment? Surely they don't have a very limited skill set only for the design of destruction. These are quite possibly some of the brightest and most industrious engineers on the planet. Is it too far-fetched to see those same people working on products for renewable energy sources? Could our government not offer them subsidies to help to work towards a sustainable, greener future instead? With the oppression of dissidents bordering on genocide in North Africa and the Middle East, surely this is the right time to hold ourselves accountable for our export of weapons to heinous regimes.
Yes, it is a large-scale decision for the government, but it was the growing voices of public dissension that finally turned the tide of opinion in the UK that slavery was not only an economic and political issue, but also a moral one. During the time of the slave trade, one would be able to say without a hint of moral contradiction that men were good slave owners, implying that they looked after their slaves well. Perhaps today we might also be able to talk about people in kind terms who deal in the arms industry. Whatever their involvement, whether it be manufacturing, providing export licenses, investing in stocks or shares, sales, export or import, the people concerned are part of a human and economic disaster industry. Arguably, we are living in the most enlightened time in human history. We know and appreciate the infinite value and potential of each human life more than at any other time. The majority, if not everybody in the world, wants to live in peace. The arms trade, on the other hand, actively promotes the destruction of human life. Putting weapons into the hands of dictators and evil regimes for profits is just as abhorrent as the end result of state oppression and murder. Whilst we can take little comfort in the fact we were the first Western nation to abolish the slave trade and then actively enforce the abolition of slavery throughout the rest of the world, it was a step in the right direction. Moreover, once the British had set a precedent, the rest of the world soon followed suit. Robert Persick said, "The social values are right only if the individual values are right. The place to improve the world is first in one's own heart, head and hands, and then work outwards from there. We as individuals have the power to demand accountability. With the growing voices of opposition in North Africa and the Middle East rising up against their oppressive regimes, this could be a similar time for the moral question of the sale of armaments as that of the Somerset case was for the abolition of slavery. If you, like me, are a little disappointed in our country's continuation in such a nefarious activity, then you'll be pleased to hear that Campaign Against the Arms Trade are going to be holding a Day of Mass Action Against the Arms Fair on the 13th of September. Please visit the Pod Delusion website for links to Kat's website and how to get involved. This has been Henry Boddington for the Pod Delusion.
A few weeks ago, we recorded a meeting of London Skeptics in the pub, in which Angela Saini spoke about her book, Geek Nation, with the event's host, Sid Rodriguez. The book explores why India's booming technology and science sector makes it a so-called geek nation. You can hear the talk in full on the Pod Delusion website at poddelusion.co.uk and on the Pod Delusion Extra podcast. Liz Luckendorf sat down with Angela to have a chat about the book. She started by asking, what exactly is the book about?
It's a journey through India to find out why and how it is achieving its ambition to become a scientific superpower. I'm a geek and I have Indian heritage. My parents are Indian. I've worked there before. So it was just a kind of way of delving into this question of why are there so many geeky Indians around the world and in India specifically, and what are they doing? What are they getting up to?
I was interested in some of the pseudoscience alongside the science, which is one of the kind of themes in the book, but especially the idea of astrologers wanting to get astrology into the curriculum.
I think you can go anywhere in the world and there's someone, some religious group somewhere or some spiritual group somewhere that wants to insert their ideas into the curriculum. And so my approach in Geek Nation was that of a journalist. I didn't go there with an axe to grind. I wanted to explore what is it that makes people believe things that are scientifically invalid or that scientists might not agree with, and how far can they take that? And in a country like India, which is a fairly young scientific society, if you look at the long, long history of science, in terms of modern science, quite a young scientific society. In terms of old science, really, really old, actually much older than Europe. But I wanted to know how that mixed up, you know, how does science enter politics, and how does it enter education, and how does it enter everybody's lives? And it's weird territory to go down. It's not always that simple. And astrology is one example. I mean, there are groups that have wanted to insert astrology into not just school education, but higher education, treat it as a, you know, a valid university mm-hmm. course. Alongside the other sciences. Now, I can't explain why it is that they're so attached to these ideas. Astrology is huge in India, by the way, and not just by, you know, ordinary people, by lots and lots of very intelligent people, scientists included.
And on the opposite end of kind of that is Lhasa. Is that how you pronounce it?
Oh, Lhasa has turned into a bit of a nightmare project, I think. The problem is that there have been lots of complaints about them moving people, allegations about them moving people off their land, about environmental concerns, about how the land was sourced, that kind of thing. So the last thing I heard, the project has slowed down a bit and not entirely stalled. But these are things that happen in a big democracy like India. People have huge problems building big installations. For example, India wants to build a big neutrino observatory, which is an amazing scientific project for the future. And they've had real issues about siting it because people don't want a neutrino observatory always in their backyard. And Lavasa is one of these projects that smack bang in the middle of the Western Ghats, a beautiful place, almost unspoiled. There are lots of tribal communities living there, rural communities making a living there, but definitely not urbanized. And so here is this big city coming in and wanting to build itself in the middle of this place, enormous. And like I write in the book, they want to have, you know, something like 250,000 residents living there in the long run. And it's not without its detractors. So that's where it stands at the moment. But in Geek Nation, I didn't really go into all of that, but I wanted to look more at why is it that this kind of place is being built in India? Why not somewhere else? So Lavasa, I'll just give you a bit of background for people who haven't read the book. It's a kind of city of the future. They're trying to build a technology led, so an IT-governed society where there'll be minimal, completely from scratch. So because it's so isolated, everything has to be provided for on-site. And they want to build from scratch a kind of minimal people-governed and mostly tech-governed society where, you know, machines will take care of all your needs and everybody will be connected and networked up. So in itself, it's quite fascinating. And it's interesting that it is in India where this project is happening because there is such a love of technology in India.
What are the kind of themes of this contrast between the tech hubs and the poverty smack dab right next to it?
Yeah.
Is Lavasa in that way kind of naive that they think they're going to keep that away from them sort of thing, that they're not going to live right next door to that?
Yeah, one of the issues that you get in the developing world is gated communities. So you get loads of them. If you go to... I lived in Delhi while I was writing the book, and I lived in a colony which has gates on either side with security guards, and after a certain time at night, that gate is closed, and you have to prove to that guard that you live in that colony in order to get in. And that's really what wealthy communities have done in order to separate themselves from the violence and the poverty and everything on the outside. And that happens a lot in the developing world. You're getting loads of these big communities going up, tower blocks in urban centres, which are heavily fortified, loads and loads of security to make sure that people essentially live separate lives, which is quite sad. It's very sad.
And what has been the reactions? I know you mentioned it. In China, they have a slightly different way of asking questions. And between all the different interviews you've done, what do most people focus on?
It's weird. I've been interviewed now by people in the US, Brazil, Italy, France, China, and India, loads of people in India. And it's interesting to see what different nations focus on. Even before the book came out, we sold the Chinese translation rights to Geek Nation. And I honestly thought that would never happen because I thought, what do the Chinese care what's happening in India? They're so huge and they're, you know, ploughing ahead regardless. But I think they're really fascinated by the creativity because that's something that in China in some ways lacks compared to some other countries. India has a really vibrant grassroots techie culture, geeky culture, whereas China not so much. And I think that's what fascinates them, even though India might be a bit more anarchic and organic, might be a nicer way of saying it. And they certainly have less funding than China has. And yet they still manage to do amazing things with it. And that's, I think, what fascinates the Chinese.
I would be fascinated to see how people translate geek. Because you wonder if it's the same kind of image across the world.
Yeah, I've wondered about that. There isn't a word for geek in Hindi. Well, if there is, nobody's told me. But they use the word geek a lot in India now. A lot. So it's not as though people don't get it, although I did meet some people who didn't know what it meant. I assume it's kind of a universal term that everybody understands.
Well, that's all the questions I have. Thank you very much for coming to Bishopsgate.
You're welcome.
If this brief interview has intrigued you and you'd like to hear more, you can check out the long edit by following links at the Pod Delusion website. You can also find links to Angela Saini's London Skeptics in the Pub Talk and find her book, Geek Nation, as well at poddelusion.co.uk. This has been Liz Lutzendorf for the Pod Delusion.
Now, many of our listeners will be the sort of people who self-identify as a sceptic, and there may even be some listeners who identify as a Christian, but I wonder how much overlap there is in that Venn diagram. Bethany Jenkins thinks that she is a Christian and a sceptic, and in this next report, she explains how she manages to be both. Personally, I think the easiest way to do it would be to follow the lead of the King James Bible and cut her in half, giving half to the sceptics and half to the Christians. But here's Bethany with more.
Hello. My name is Bethany Jenkins, and I have been a regular listener of the Pod Delusion for the past few months. The reason I wanted to talk to you is that I consider myself to be a Christian sceptic, and I'd like to talk to you about that. On the whole, my faith is a private thing to me, and I do not evangelise. I have never, ever tried to convert anybody, and I'm not trying to convert anybody by this talk now. The reason I wanted to talk to you is that I get quite wound up by many people lumping all Christians under one banner and assuming that because we have a shared faith, we cannot be sceptical about other things, or indeed about things that come under the realm of Christianity. For example, in the past the Pod Delusion has had an article about creationism in schools. I thoroughly disagree with creationism, and if I heard that my son's school was going to be teaching such a thing, I would be one of the first parents to complain, and I would do so vehemently. The only way he should hear about creationism, in my opinion, is as a thing that some lunatics believe. There was also a recording from the pub during the rapture party. Had I been nearby, I would have been happy to have attended, and happy to state that I did not think that the rapture would be happening. I also think that scaring gullible people in this way is wrong, and indeed unchristian. I suppose that the tenets that I largely live my life by are, love the Lord your God, and love thy neighbour as thyself. To me, this means that I am accepting of other people's faiths and beliefs, and although I would be happy to discuss them and potentially raise counter-arguments, I would respect their right to hold them. I'm not going to go through everything that I do and don't support, but I'll just state that I completely support gay and lesbian relationships, use of contraception, and women's rights. I disagree with any sort of war, and particularly ones that try to impose their beliefs onto people. In fact, I'm a pacifist, although maybe that's a subject for another time. With regards to faith schools, I'm not in favour of them as I think that imposing beliefs on anyone isn't a good thing to do. I think that children should be taught to think critically about the world and not to just take things at face value. I do not consider my 4-year-old son to be a Christian or an atheist as he hasn't got the experience to make a considered decision. He does come to church with me and has been christened, but I am always careful when talking about faith with him that he's aware that these are my beliefs and that others, Daddy particularly, doesn't agree with me. My husband considers himself to be a moderate atheist and respects my beliefs. We were married in church, our son was christened in church, and I trust that he would organise a Christian funeral for me when the time comes. He says that he's perfectly happy with this as it makes no difference to him, but it is important to me. Given that I don't follow the party line, you may ask why I consider myself to be a Christian. I don't think that it will ever be possible to prove the existence or otherwise of God, and in my view, it is my faith in this that is critical to my beliefs, and since faith can only be a personal thing, it is difficult to explain. I do attend church and find great comfort in this, although I'm aware that this may just be a habit from childhood. My point really is that although some Christians are fundamentalists and have radical beliefs which should be challenged, to use Christians as an all-encompassing word to describe a group of people who should be slated is unfair. I do think that there is room in the sceptical mind for some belief, and indeed I challenge my own beliefs, but my view is that faith is a private thing for me, and I ask that I am given space to hold my view without being lumped in with a group of fanatics. Thank you. This was Bethany Jenkins talking for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week we turn to pregnancy, which eventually leads to the disgusting miracle of childbirth. Matt Kaiser is a new father, and in the next report talks about all the unsolicited nonsense and advice that he's been bombarded with over the course of the last 9 months. Incidentally, if you've got any unsolicited advice for Matt, why not post a comment on the Poddelusion website? So here's Matt, with more.
I became a dad for the first time last week, and it was a pretty magical experience. Jerry Coyne, evolutionary geneticist and author of Why Evolution is True, wrote recently on his blog about experiences akin to those attributed to a higher power, in which the sheer awesomeness of an event can bring about a sense of transcendence, but separate from anything supernatural or religious, and this was definitely one of those for me. Anyway, transcendent non-supernatural experiences aside, now I have to look after this little bundle of squidge. I obviously want to give him the best possible upbringing I can provide, with all the right support and nurturing, so that he becomes an all-round lovely person. I could trust that millions of years of evolution has provided me with a paternal instinct that will kick in as and when needed, thereby ensuring that the fitness of my offspring will be increased. However, with such responsibility, winging it is a little scary, and as someone who strives to be a rational, critical thinker, I would like to know that the decisions I make as a parent have the backing of more than a gut feeling or the instruction of age or religious doctrine. Up until now, it's been hard. I don't think there's ever been a time in my life when unsolicited advice has been so forthcoming. During my wife's pregnancy, everyone seems to have an opinion on what to eat, which alternative therapy is a must, what gender the baby definitely is, and so on. And it seemed a lot of this advice was supported by mysticism, hearsay, or just plain anecdotal evidence, even from health professionals such as midwives. From light-hearted gender tests such as how fast the hairs on the mother's legs are growing, to more consequential homeopathic treatments for inducing labour and pain relief during delivery. Some people, my partner included, were convinced that I must have a feeling as to whether it was a girl or a boy, and thought I was being deliberately awkward by not playing along, especially when I decided to answer that I really felt it was a girl, and I was about 50% sure of it. Many of these intuitions get perpetuated by a massive confirmation bias. All the people who guessed a boy said, "I told you so, I just knew it, the way you were carrying that bump, it must have been a boy." While the other remaining half, who had predicted a girl, remained strangely silent and seemed to forget their prediction altogether. This is all jolly fun, but this confirmation bias seems evident in advice about upbringing too. There's a wealth of cod psychological theories to explain someone's personality, their birth order, the amount of parental discipline, the prescribed feed-sleep regimens as a baby, etc., with proponents seemingly retrofitting individuals who conform to these ideas to support their claim, whilst ignoring all other individuals who don't. I realise many a clinical psychologist has achieved sizable book sales with such an approach, but maybe that's for another time. Some other claims were beautiful examples of some common logical fallacies with which many a Poddelusion listener will be familiar. Because an event follows another, there must be a causal link. One advocate of acupuncture treatment to bring on labour was convinced of its efficacy because her labour started the day after the acupuncture procedure. I mean, it didn't seem a huge surprise to me that a baby should arrive close to the expected birth date, at which time the mother was also trying all sorts of things to bring on labour, but to causally link the two events seems somewhat flaky. And this came from a PhD graduate too. Newspaper stories didn't help. "Sleep on your left to avoid stillbirth," say medics, one headline confidently proclaimed. "Using your phone while pregnant can lead to behavioural problems in children," screamed another. Worrying stuff indeed. When I tried to explain some of the issues with these reports, such as correlation does not mean causation, sample sizes and statistical power, absolute risk versus relative risk, reporting and recall biases, eyes would invariably roll. Other instances of possible misinterpretation would creep in. Common talk of the body being designed in a particular way, whilst I recognise that sometimes I may be accused of semantic nitpicking, it did seem to lead some people to always look for a reason for this and for that. The theory often cited by natural childbirth advocates that labour pain must occur to provide an ecstatic bonding sensation seems something of an ad hoc supposition, although I guess this merely puts them on a par with some popular evolutionary psychologists. Whenever I try to inquire about the evidence or statistics behind a particular claim or point to evidence that, say, there is actually scant evidence that more births occur during a full moon, that familiar glazed expression would appear and a cursory muttering of "trust the scientist" might be offered. But don't let evidence get in the way of a good factoid, eh? So, back to caring for my child. I mean, people often want a cast-iron guaranteed list of what to do and what not to do, but scientific guidance rarely works like that. One can make a recommendation on the best available evidence, but those recommendations are liable to change, and attitudes and practices need to be flexible enough to shift too. My mum, for instance, listening to the pervading advice at the time, slept on my front to reduce the chances of sudden infant death syndrome through choking, but evidence since then has accumulated that shows an increased risk of cot desk with front sleeping, and now babies are overwhelmingly slept on their backs. Whilst experiential advice can be useful, and I know I'll certainly be looking into family and friends who have been there, done that, for guidance in moments of panic, I also appreciate that what works for one baby does not necessarily work for another. I hope to apply a bit of trial and error with the direction of empirically validated advice and see what works for us, and ignore those who provide a generic recipe for bringing up a baby, which tends to have been tested mostly on their unscientifically selected low sample size. Gina Ford, I'm looking at you. But it's obviously impossible to perform a systematic review of the scientific literature for every behaviour and trait. But there are clearly sources of advice that pay more attention to scientific research than others, and so a certain amount of fact-checking is worthwhile to test whether a source is reliable. Well, I've only started to dip my toe into the post-labour period to consider what sort of environment I should strive to create, but here are a few things I've picked up already. 1. Be wary of any sentence that starts, "They say that." 2. Do as I do, not as I say. There's a wealth of evidence that children who witness their parents carry out a particular behaviour, such as smoking, violence, even academic work, are more likely to behave in that way as adults. 3. Open and honest attitudes towards sex. Despite what Nadine Dorries may perpetuate, evidence suggests that parents who take a more positive attitude towards sexuality can be beneficial for the child's comfort with their own sexuality. And religiosity appears to have little impact on sexual risk-taking. The bigger influence is parental affection. 4. Strike a balance. Musical training can be beneficial in attention, cognition and language development, and early take-up, higher parental support, practice and friendly rather than technically able music teachers all help. But there is evidence that successful childhood musicians need teachers who are not too relaxed but not too pushy. Oh, and don't read Mum's Net. This is Matt Kayser for the Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do remember to check out the Pod Delusion website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to Angela Sainer's Skeptics in the Pub Talk in full, as well as a longer version of Blakely's report on censorship and Parliament. Also on our website, you can listen back to older episodes of the programme, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or even get involved with the show yourself. Awkward begging alert, if you enjoy the Pod Delusion, why not send us some cash to help us do what we do? Doing this podcast is surprisingly expensive at times, and you can donate £5 or £10 a month or make one-off donations to help us carry on producing the podcast every week. You can find buttons to do so and get a really good feeling of satisfaction after doing so at poddelusion.co.uk. Finally, if you're in London on the 13th of September, do come down to London Skeptics in the Pub at the Monarch in Camden. It will be the Pod Delusion's second birthday, and to celebrate, we're recording an episode live in front of an audience at the pub. It's going to be amazing. We've already booked Helen Arney, the amazing skeptical musician, to provide us with some music at the end, so do come down to that. You can find out more on our website. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Simon Howard, Peter Rowlett, Sally Fadley, Blakely Nixon, Henry Boddington, Liz Luckendorf, Bethany Jenkins, Matt Kaiser, and me, James O'Malley. The sketch coming up is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Global Village. I'm Jeremy Manpax. Tonight, in the aftermath of the riots, we'll be asking, why? I'm joined by Mickey Swan, a self-confessed rioter. Mr. Swan, Mickey, why?
Well, we were just showing them, bruv.
Showing who what exactly?
Eh?
Well, just who do you claim to be showing?
Well, the government and the police and that.
So you're saying the riots were politically motivated?
Well, yeah. Well, and there was free stuff.
It wasn't free.
Well,
it was...
no one paid, bruv. No one paid. In my book, that makes it well free.
No, it was stealing.
Yeah, but it was well good.
That's it, is it? The only reason you can offer for the deplorable behaviour and breakdown in the fabric of society, it was well good. Pathetic.
And well, there was always...
What words of wisdom are you going to offer now?
Well, it's just that if you was looking for a more philosophical answer, that you could always consider Karl Marx's theory on dialectical materialism.
Pardon?
You know, Karl Marx's theory on the dialectic vis-à-vis the proletariat and the bourgeoisie.
What?
No, nothing, bruv. Hey, Manpex, we got Gucci loafers.
How much?
For you, bruv, 30.
Suede, 9.5?
Yeah, bruv.
I'll take 2 pairs for 50.
Nicely.